This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We had expected to be joined today by the New York Times Jerusalem Bureau Chief James Bennett, but he was on deadline and had to postpone our interview until next week. That's the bad news. The good news is that my guest is music impresario George Wein. He created the Newport Jazz Festival in 1954 and the Newport Folk Festival in 1959. He also founded the Cool Jazz Festival, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, the JVC Festival, and other music festivals around the world. He started his life in music as a jazz pianist. Here he is singing and playing, recorded in 1955.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven? You'll find your fortune falling all over town. Be sure that your umbrella is upside down.
George Wein has written a new autobiography called Myself Among Others. In 1950, before he started his festivals, he opened a club in Boston called Storyville that featured the top jazz performers of the time. I asked him how his experiences as a musician helped shape what he wanted out of the club.
I guess I wanted to make a living. I didn't know much about what I was going to do for my life. But I wanted it to be known as a musician's club, a club owned by someone that loved the music, was part of the music, and presented the best possible jazz available.
As opposed to what kind of clubs had you performed in that weren't very friendly to musicians?
Most of the clubs were people owned by individuals who had a liquor license, and they wanted to sell liquor and put in music, hoping that they'd draw some people.
You write in your book, "I didn't know what it was like to be the man until opening Storyville. Suddenly, I was in the position of hiring musicians, most of whom were older than I was and often famous. Many were African Americans who had an inherent distrust of whites, never mind white nightclub owners. What were some of the difficulties you faced being the man?"
The basic thing was that I loved these musicians, and I found out that they did not love me. I was, as I say, the man, and I would ask them things, and they just would look at me with a blank stare sometimes because they didn't trust what I had to say or what I asked of them. That was difficult to understand. It took me years to fully comprehend and how to accept that.
Well, how did you learn to gain the musician's trust?
It's a good question, and every musician had a different reason. I was talking about Thelonious Monk having and being on the road with him. When I had to run up and down the stairs five or six times to get him on the stage, and I finally yelled at him, "Thelonious, get the hell on the stage," and he went up and played for 45 minutes a drum solo, had the drummer featured, and he came off the stage, and I said to him, what was that all about, Thelonious? He said, "You hadn't ought to yelled at me." And I told him I ran up and down the stairs, and I was getting too old and fat for that. He says, "You had to run up and down the stairs? I don't blame you for yelling at me." And that was when I gained the trust of Thelonious Monk. In many areas with different musicians, there were the different story. With Miles Davis, I bounced a check on him, and he got the message that we were going to be equals, and he wasn't going to push us around, and I wasn't going to push him around.
Wait, you intentionally bounced a check on him?
No. I intentionally bounced it because he didn't play the job. And he figured that I had paid him in 2 days before the job, and I bounced the check on him, and he says, "Well, why did you bounce the check?" And I said, "Why didn't you play the gig?" And so that solved that problem.
Did it bother you to have to sometimes play the heavy with musicians who you kind of idolized?
No, I never really played the heavy except when it actually was necessary. Basically, I established a rapport with them. I found out that they respected me for playing the piano. And then when I married my wife, they knew where my feelings were, my deepest feelings were. And that meant a lot in gaining the respect of African-American musicians.
Your wife is African-American.
My wife is African-American. We've been married since 1959, which is a long time, since we'd have been put in jail in 25% of the states at that time.
You have hired many of your idols over the years to play at festivals and to play in your club when you owned it. Did some of your idols not really remain your idols because you saw their behavior off stage?
I used to say to Stan Getz, I said, Stan, how can you be so evil and play so beautifully? And Stan would say to me, man, I'm changed. I'm not going to be the same.
What kind of behavior did he display that led you to call him evil?
He was evil. What evil is? He treated musicians badly. He treated club owners badly. He was involved with drugs. And he was you couldn't trust his word. And you had to be very careful with him. But he was a great, great musician.
Did he lie to you about performances that you expected him to play?
I think he lied to me about everything we ever talked about at different times. But I loved him. I really did. And at the end, we were very close friends.
Now, when you were running Storyville, there was something of an alcohol scandal that you discovered. Describe what happened.
I leased a room from a hotel. I didn't own a liquor license, and we were buying the liquor from the hotel. The next thing I know, my bartenders were telling me that I was getting Johnny Walker Black Label Scotch, but it didn't have Johnny Walker Black Label Scotch in the bottle. The label said it. And it seemed that the hotel owner was putting this stuff on me and charging me regular prices. That's why he gave me such a good deal. I was very young, and finally people were complaining. I went up to the hotel owner and told him I had to have my liquor in sealed bottles. He wanted to change the deal. I found out that I didn't even think about it. I closed the club in one night. I could not start business with that kind of a dishonest reputation. My feelings were so deep about it, I didn't even stop to think about it. I closed the club. I knew then that honesty was important to me.
When you closed the club, did you make some kind of public statement?
No, we just said we're closed and we'll reopen in another location as soon as we can. And I did not indict the hotel owner.
So you were able to open the club again in a different location?
We opened about 8 weeks later, never caught the atmosphere that we had when we first opened, which was quite sensational for 6 weeks. But as the years went on, we played the greatest artists in jazz. I don't care whether it was Ella Fitzgerald or Sarah Vaughan or Miles or Duke or Louis, Art Tatum, Bird. They all played Storyville, and that's where I really learned my trade, and that's what has directed me to where I am today.
You gave up your club, Storyville, and then ended up starting the Newport Jazz Festival. So what was your first concept of the out-of-doors summer jazz festival?
The concept was to present jazz from J to Z. I always had that feeling. So I presented a group like with Eddie Condon and Wild Bill Davison on the same bill with Lee Konitz and Lenny Tristano. And in the middle, you know, Ella Fitzgerald and Gene Krupa, a total view of the spectrum of jazz. I always felt that's what a jazz festival should be. We can't always do it, but in those days it was not difficult because there were so many great jazz musicians still with us.
What were your first thoughts about getting good sound outside?
That was difficult because there was no history of good sound outside, and we experimented for 2 or 3 years before we found out what to do. The second year in particular was difficult, and that was the year that Miles Davis put his horn right in the microphone and came out with a beautiful Round Midnight, and Columbia signed him, and that was the kickoff to his great career in the 50s.
One of the most famous performances at a Newport Jazz Festival was the Duke Ellington performance in 1956. Why was this a turning point in Ellington's career?
Ellington, to me, was a god always. I didn't realize that he wasn't doing business wherever he went. Well, he made a record of this incredible performance. It was recorded, and it was the biggest-selling album he ever had. What happened that night was literally a happening. A woman started to dance in the audience. It made news the next day. Ellington broke up the festival. The crowd was orderly, but for the first time they were all standing on their feet. And Ellington reached out. He made the cover of Time magazine very shortly after that. And ever after that, he said, I was born at Newport in 1956.
The musical centerpiece of that night was a performance of Diminuendo in Blue, and the saxophonist Paul Gonzalez blew about 27 choruses on that in his solo. That's a lot of choruses. That's a long time. What were you thinking when his solo went on and on?
I was worried about crowd control because I saw the crowd coming towards the stage and standing up, but really there was no serious problem. I think the record shows that I was saying, Duke, take it out, take it out. But it was so exciting that we were all caught up in it. And what I learned that night was the way Duke Ellington brought the crowd down after Gonzalez finished. He had Johnny Hodges play a beautiful ballad and a blues, and the crowd just settled back into their chairs. It was a beautiful experience.
Well, let's hear part of the Paul Gonzalez solo on Diminuendo in Blue. Paul Gonzalez soloing on Duke Ellington's Diminuendo in Blue in the Ellington Band's performance at the 1956 Newport Jazz Festival. My guest, George Ween, was the creator of the Newport Jazz Festival and many other festivals, whose new memoir is called Myself, Among Others, A Life in Music. Well, George Ween, a little later in that evening, the Duke Ellington performance was going on and on. You wanted the performance to end, and Ellington wasn't ending it. Why were you anxious to wrap things up?
I was anxious because I was concerned that if it was the first time I ever felt any nervousness about a crowd. And I don't remember it that well. I really recollect it from the recording where my voice is heard telling Duke, no more, Duke, no more, you know. But Duke was not going to give up that moment. That was one of the great moments in his life, with 12 or 15,000 people cheering for him and the band sounding so great. So he just kept doing it until he realized that the evening was over. But he did the right thing. He really did the right thing.
He did the right thing in keeping going and not listening to you to stop?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, look, I'm only me. I mean, Duke Ellington's Duke Ellington. He did know a little bit more than I did. I was very young, and I was learning from him every minute.
Let me play the track that's called Riot Control on the CD version of this 1956 Newport concert. And here you are at the mic trying to end the concert as people start booing you.
That's it!
George Ween, what's it like to stand before thousands and thousands of people who are booing you because you want to end the concert?
I never was a great baseball player, so I don't know what it was to strike out with the bases loaded. But I really didn't hear the booing. I mean, in all honesty, you don't hear those things. Your mind is so involved with what you're thinking at the moment that you don't hear those things.
At the Newport Jazz Festival, when you started the festival, were the audiences pretty integrated? Because there were obviously black and white fans for the performance that you were presenting, but it was an area of New England that I think was very predominantly white.
We had a small percentage of blacks at the beginning of the festival. There were always There were always blacks that liked jazz. There were never a mass. The mass audience was usually white. We had a few racial problems the very first year when some of the hotels weren't used to blacks coming to the hotels and registering, and they refused. But after 1 year, that ended, and a few years later, they elected an African-American mayor of Newport. So you have your influence, and what you do influences the attitude of people. And we're very proud of that. And we problems are always there. The whole thing is to just not fight the problems. In a sense, just make people aware that these problems are useless and that they don't have any meaning. And let's go straight ahead.
Okay, well, you not only did the Newport Jazz Festival, you created the Newport Folk Festival. Were you interested in folk music?
I'm interested in all musics, including opera and symphony and folk music and world music. I love artistry. Artistry is what draws me. It's not the style or the concept. If a person's an artist, I can appreciate him. And I used to play a lot of folk artists in Storyville with Needing an Attraction every week, and I was influenced from Bonnie Josephson's Cafe Society and Max Gordon at the Village Vanguard. I went to their clubs before I had my own club. And so Pete Seeger and Odetta and groups like that and artists like that had played Storyville. Now, we had presented tap dance afternoons and gospel afternoons at the jazz festival, and I said, we'll do a folk afternoon. But I found out we had much more available and we should do a festival.
Why don't you share one of your personal high points from the Newport Folk Festival?
I think that one of the personal high points was when we brought this a tin whistle player from South Africa, Spokes Marciani, and we didn't know how he got there. I mean, we sent him the fare for a ticket, and he was lost, so we thought, and finally he showed up just on our doorstep in Newport. He went on the stage. And we used to draw 15,000 people at that time, all avid folk fans. And he played with that tin whistle, and he had a jazz feeling. And Pete Seeger and I went up to play with him. I played the piano, and he played the guitar. And he just played, sounded like Lester Young on a tin whistle. And when he finished playing, the entire 15,000 people stood up and cheered. It was a magical moment.
One of the most famous moments from the Newport Folk Festival was when Bob Dylan performed with his band, and they used amplifiers. So it was electric. Dylan had gone electric.
That was the expression. Dylan went electric.
Yeah, and a lot of his fans felt betrayed that one of their folk music heroes had now plugged in. What were you thinking when he plugged in?
That was a time I was aware of the booing. Some people have tried to write that there wasn't any booing. There was a lot of booing, and there was a lot of consternation backstage. And there were legends that have come down that are untrue about Pete Seeger wanting to take an axe and cut the sound system. That just was not true. He was in a car holding his ears and said, ask me to do something about it. I said, there's nothing we can do, Pete. But what I did was I went up to Dylan after he finished and I on the stage, and I said, Bob, you've got to go back and do an acoustic tune. And he said, I don't have a guitar. And I said, it's a folk festival. I turned around, does anybody have a guitar? And naturally, about 40 guitars went in the air, and Petey Yarrow gave him a guitar, and he did go back and sing It's All Over Now, Baby Blue. And it was a very poignant moment. It was more important historically than it was to me at that moment, because I was just acting as a producer and acting by instinct.
Why did your instincts tell you he should go back on stage and play something acoustic?
I had, again, I was not concerned with the riot, but I was concerned with the crowd, the feeling of the crowd. It was a terrible disappointment to the real Dylan fans who didn't know anything about his going electric. And it really was an important moment that had changed the approach to music by young people who were folk fans, because a lot of their friends had adopted the new music of the Beatles, and they were fighting them, saying, no, the real music is our folk music. And when Dylan went electric, it gave them the right to go along with their friends, and then they all became lemmings and went in the direction of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and were part of their whole youth. situation, which was great, you know, but it took away a lot of individuality in listening to music.
If you really thought it was great, you wouldn't have used the word lemmings.
Well, you know, music had never had that feeling before. Everybody had the concept of what was good didn't always relate to what was the most popular. So once the rock and roll world came in, the most important groups were the ones that sold the most records. In jazz, Glenn Miller sold more records than Duke Ellington ever dreamed of selling, but Duke Ellington was still the boss. In piano, there were a lot of great piano players, but all of the piano players stood up when Art Tatum came into the room. In rock and roll, they stood up when the guy that sold the most records came into the room, and that's always the way it's been.
What did you first think when you watched the Woodstock Festival? I'm going to assume that you weren't at the festival, but that you watched the news about the festival.
I really didn't comprehend it. I didn't understand it. That was the year that I played a lot of rock groups at Newport in 1969, and I had played them because the underground press, which had become so important, was demeaning jazz and saying that Ian Anderson was a better flute player than Rahsaan Roland Kirk, or as good, and Ginger Baker was as great a drummer as Elvin Jones. And so I called a friend of mine and said, which of these groups can really play? And I put a lot of them on the festival, and there were so many groups on the festival that Jimi Hendrix called me personally, which nobody believes. He called me personally and said he'd like to be on the festival, and I said, Jimmy, I don't have any room for you. And anybody says you didn't have room for Jimi Hendrix has to be crazy in the legends of what's happened in the rock and roll world. But I knew there was a lot of something going on up there, but I was not aware of it till I was standing on Broadway, and I saw hundreds of kids with backpacks getting on buses to go up to the Catskills. It was an amazing phenomenon. I'd never seen anything like it, and I wasn't aware that it was happening.
When you watched the news footage of it, did it strike you as like a good thing for the future of festivals or a bad thing?
Well, it wasn't a good thing for the future of Woodstock. They didn't do another festival for 25 years, and we did 25 festivals in between that. So I don't know. That's a tough question. They're two different worlds, rock festivals and jazz festivals. They're closer now than they used to be. Because music is a curiosity developing among young people to hear different kinds of music, and world music and everything has been influenced by the electronics now. So it's very seldom you hear any group that doesn't have some electronic concern in their presentation. So they're closer now, but I don't know. Rock and roll is so huge in our society. It's affected our clothing. It's affected our food. It's affected our style, everything. And we're, in a sense, an anachronism in our love and direction for jazz, but we still stay alive, and we find that festivals like New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival can still draw 100,000 people when we have great programs and people come for the food and for the crafts and for the many diverse musics we have.
A couple of years after Woodstock, in 1971, you ran a festival that you ended up basically closing early. There nearly was a riot in this one. What was it about?
That was 1971. There were no rock festivals, and the underground press, which was quite important in those days, it's not so important now. They said there were no festivals happening, but there were some good sounds at Newport, and if you went up to Newport, you could stay on the hill outside and outside the festival and hear the music. So hundreds of kids and thousands of kids started coming into town and camping on the hillside. And I had asked the police to keep the hillside clear, but they ended up double-crossing us and sending people to the hillside to keep them out of town. What happened was that those kids sat there and they were getting stoned and really getting stoned. The drug scene was very full in those years, very important in 1971 to young people. And they just announced they were going to be on the stage at 9 o'clock on Saturday night, and they got together. We had a chain-link fence. They put 200-300 bodies together and at the fences in various places, and when they finally broke down, it looked like tanks had gone through the fences. They went on the stage. I got up on the stage with my wife, and we said, please file out. We had 20,000 people at that time. The crowds had grown from 15 to 20,000. They filed out without incident, a sense of resignation that there was no control over what was happening in the world at that time, of the world of young people. Free music was what it was all about.
So they wanted to storm the stage, not to perform on stage, but to just make a statement that the music should be free and open to everyone.
I asked them why they didn't have any talent. They said, how do you know we don't have any talent? I said, because you wouldn't be silly running around out here trying to break this fence down if you had any talent. I was standing right there at the fence when they were breaking it down. Father O'Connor, a Catholic priest, was with me. It didn't stop them from doing it. It was just part of a way of life at that time. Music should be free, and they were just doing their thing, that's all. But there was no riot at the festival. The cops cleared the hillside and cleared the kids at 5 o'clock the next morning. It was all over.
That must have left you with a really bad feeling.
It left me with a sense of emptiness for a while, but my wife tells me that even as things were happening, I was planning on what I might do the next year. And I realized that the Newport Festival had significance and meaning not only to me and to the America as a jazz phenomenon, but to the world as a symbol of what jazz was. And I knew that you could not do a festival at that time in suburban areas and vacation areas and resorts. So I said, we have to take it to an urban area. And I said, the best place to do it would be New York City. And so that's when I took the festival, which is now the JVC Jazz Festival, to New York, and then established the format for all urban festivals throughout the world right now. And what it did was the use of many facilities, boat rides in the Hudson River, midnight jam sessions, Carnegie Hall, Philharmonic Hall, dances, forums and panels, and just, you know, like 40 events during the course of a festival, going the course of 10 days. We kept Carnegie Hall and Philharmonic, which is now Avery Fisher Hall, open after they both agreed to keep it open for me, because they used to close for the summer. And now New York is just a festival all summer long, because before it was dead. We were responsible for bringing New York to life in the summer. We really were.
Not too long ago, your festivals would you know, would always have an anchor who would be, you know, a center, like a focal point, like a musician who was like a brilliant musician, but also very kind of commercially popular. Miles Davis, Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan, people of that caliber. And like those three people and many others, many of them have passed. And those people who were both, you know, the most revered musicians and singers in jazz were also among the biggest draws. Is it harder to find those people now who have the reverence and the draw at the same time?
It's very difficult. You have people that have the draw, like and as a singer, Diana Krall is a wonderful draw and a wonderful artist. But something happened this year that was very interesting to me. Ornette Coleman played in New Orleans, and he played in the jazz tent there. The people were mesmerized by him. There were thousands of people crowding in the tent and outside of the tent. They cheered every note, every solo that Ornette played. This would not have happened years ago. But the ears of the crowd, the ears of the jazz listener, are opened up to new sounds. And Ornette, you talk about reverence, there was a total reverence for Ornette Coleman.
You've seen many of the musicians who you've loved most, who you were closest with, and who were among the greatest musicians, you know, in the history of the music. You've seen many of them die. Do you ever feel lonely out there, like you've outlived so many of the people who you came up with?
It isn't that I feel lonely, but sometimes I hear music and it's talking to me, and I literally get tears in my eyes, and 'cause the music means so much to me. And having known so many of these great players, not just the big names like Duke, but Louis, I knew them all. But, you know, the ones that I write about in the book that are not necessarily the genius, but they're the troops, you know, the ones that made jazz happen. and to which we owe an unfathomable debt. And when I hear those people, and, you know, not only did I listen to them, I played with a lot of them. A lot of them toured with the Newport All-Stars. I mean, I played with people like Lester Young and Sidney Bechet, some of the greatest artists in the world, and Clark Terry and Buddy Tate and Buck Clayton. And, you know, from the history of jazz, I've had the good fortune to have played with and worked with so many wonderful players. And they talk to me, and I get a beautiful feeling about it, not a sad feeling. It's a beautiful feeling that I knew those people and was close to them, and they were part of my life, and maybe I was part of their lives.
You started your career playing and doing some singing as well. Do you still play piano?
I still play. I played for 5 days. I haven't played very much in the past few years, but I played for 5 days in Bern at a festival there where Hans Suhrberg asked me to put an all-star group together. And I asked Regina Carter if she would play with me.
The violinist.
The violinist, and she's in a young, beautiful young girl, and she's in, I guess, in her 30s. And she agreed to play with me. She said it would be an honor. I says, don't say it'll be an honor until you hear the way I play. Because we had never played together. We went there. It was it was an inspiration to play with that young lady. I mean, after 2 nights, my hands got in shape, and I had a good band. I had Rodney Jones on guitar and Jesse Davis on alto and Alvin Queen on drums and Juan Vachet on cornet. It was a mixed-up type of band, a young clarinet player by the name of Evan Christopher from New Orleans who plays in an older style. I had bebop players, traditional players. I had a band that went in so many different directions, but every night we got a standing round of applause for 5 nights. We played 3 hours a night, you know, 2-hour-and-a-half sets. It was really thrilling, and I felt that I could still play a little bit. But when I hear great piano players, I realize the inadequacies of my playing, so I just do my thing for my own kicks, and I don't try to do more than I can do.
There have been festivals where I could see that the big draw was going to be, say, the fusion group. This was a few years ago. And that, you know, a few musicians on the bill who I figured were your personal favorites, that they were going to be in, like, the smaller performance spaces because they weren't going to do quite as well as, say, the big commercial fusion group. Has being in this business for so long ever made you cynical about popular taste?
Oh, yes. I mean, you do get cynical about popular taste. There's no question about that. If I wasn't cynical about that, I'd be a rock and roll producer and would have made a lot more money. I mean, I'm a great compromiser in many respects, because I believe the formula for my longevity is a concept of commercialism with credibility. We always, all these little musicians you talk about are people that I have great respect for. We did a concert just the other week about saluting two veterans like Frank West and Joe Wilder, and we didn't have a big audience, but the response was electric, and it was just total warmth. So the point is credibility in presenting young musicians and new musicians and new things along with the artists that sell tickets. That's the reason we're still alive. That's the reason that we're still in business after 50 years. Next year's the 50th anniversary of Newport.
Wow. In writing this memoir, you had to pick through your mind and hopefully some journals that you had, if in fact you had any journals, in order to revive the past, you know, as you lived it. What was that process like for you of trying to remember things that happened to you over the years?
The process of remembering was relatively easy because I only remembered what I remembered. A lot of that sounds strange. But what I remembered vividly, and that's what I put down. The things that I didn't remember too vividly, I didn't use. The young man that worked with me in the book, Nate Chinnan, did some research on things, and he went through a lot of my papers. And we found some fascinating things, for instance, letters I had written to Miles Davis that I had forgotten all about. that I use in the book, where I start off one of the letters, "I have always known you were evil, but I never knew you were stupid or crazy."
What were you writing him about?
Well, that we made an offer for a European trip, and he was holding me off, you know, and couldn't get an answer out of him. And I said, "Look, if the other guy gives you a better offer, go with them," you know, something like that. And then he met my wife on the street and said, "I like George, but he doesn't respect me." And so then I wrote him another letter saying how much I respected him, and, you know, that he was one of the important figures in jazz, and my whole life was working with important people, you know. And after that, we, you know, along with the other things, we developed a good friendship. But Miles liked to be talked to that way, because that's the way he talked to people, you see. So I established a rapport. But we had to dig to find those letters, and when I found them, I was so happy to use them, because they did reflect my attitude and how I worked with Miles and how I established a relationship with a guy who was really a unique human being, Miles Davis, and in his way a very beautiful, beautiful man.
Well, George Wein, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
This is a wonderful interview, and thank you very much. You did read the book, and that's the most important thing. A lot of people interview, they don't read the book, and you asked me wonderful questions, and I want to thank you very much for that.
George Wein's new autobiography is called Myself Among Others. Here he is singing and playing piano, recorded in 1955. Ruby Braff is featured on trumpet.
The bird with feathers of blue is waiting for you back in your old backyard. You'll find your castles in Spain 'neath your window pane, back in your own backyard. You can go to the east, go to the west. Someday you'll come, weary at heart, back where you started from. You'll find your happiness lies right under your eyes, back in your own backyard. To the east, go to the west, someday you'll come, weary at heart, back where you started from. You'll find your happiness lies right under your eyes, back in your own backyard.
George Wein from the reissue of his 1955 recording, Wein, Women, and Song.